Blog Talk Radio.
Full Fill Radio, a voice you can trust. Broadcasting live presents Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and William Bell. Join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central as we bring you exciting, sound, challenging, and comforting messages regarding the end times. Thank you for tuning in today. Don Preston is the founder of Preterist Research Institute, or PRI. Don is a prolific author, having written and published 19 books, a host of audio and DVD studies, and is a debater and defender of the full preterist view. His websites are BibleProphecy.com, Eschatology.org, and DonKPreston.com. William Bell is the founder of AllThingsFulfilled.com Ministries and has a website bearing the same name, and has authored 3 books, audios, and DVDs. He has published hundreds of articles and recordings. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Guys and a Bible broadcast with Don Preston and William Bell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is William Bell, and welcome to Two Guys and a Bible. With me is Dr. Don Preston. Don, how are you today?
I am doing absolutely wonderful, William. So good. To be back again this week. A little bit of a heads up, as you already know, I will not be here next week. Daniel will be with you. I'll be with my wife. She has to have another 3 or 4 days of follow-up testing and consultations, et cetera, et cetera. And so we will be out of pocket. I'll be actually in and out, but mostly I'll be out of pocket as far as being able to do any work on the radio and what have you. So I appreciate Daniel being willing to fill in for me. He will also be doing my morning musings so that I don't have to worry about that of a morning, and that I can give my full attention to my wife and her situation. But anyway, it is good to be back this evening. And, you know, I've been following the little saga there of you and Daniel at the South Haven Power Lectures there in South Haven, Mississippi. And it's just such an incredibly sad situation of what happened there. And I'm sure you'll relate that. Folks on Facebook already know what happened. But anyway, we're going to have some fun reviewing the presentations
Absolutely.
That were given there. You know, William, I've had some people contact me privately, and one person posted publicly on my Facebook page just a while ago, and they said, is preterism the number one heresy in all of the churches of Christ right now that's calling for all these different lectureships and all these different attempts to answer it? And I said,
where I sit,
yeah, it's absolutely hilarious. And of course, William, you and I can well remember the days, not been all that terribly long ago, in which there was an overt boycott, a conspiracy of silence in the churches of Christ, not to even talk about this, not to address it, and no matter what, don't study it. And so now, all of a sudden, one lectureship after another, you know, Daniel and I were on the phone earlier in the day, and he was just cataloging all of the different debates, the different lectures and seminars and speeches that are being addressed against us. And that tells you that in the churches of Christ, there is full-blown panic. There is absolute full-blown panic about what are they going to do about this.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that in the previous time there was this conspiracy of silence. I think it really kind of still exists, other than the fact now they've been forced to say something. They can no longer sit back and just think that if we don't say anything, it's going to go away, and right. Which was, you know, their intent from the beginning. But, you know, it's like leaven, works quietly, but it works. And now it's beginning to manifest itself in many places, and it's causing some issues and some concerns. On the other hand, that's not all bad, because some of the people who are considering it are very I would say open, or at least they're willing to sit down and study and consider it. And I'm grateful for that. It's just, you know, it had to be brought to their attention. And now that they're getting the opportunities to see it debated, it's even better, because now you can see both sides of the issue. People can get some clarity on some things, and we can clear up a lot of the misperceptions and misconceptions of what we teach and what we believe.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's like the Proverbs writer said back in, if I'm not mistaken, it's Proverbs 18. I want to say it's Proverbs 18, 17, somewhere along in there. It says, the one who is first to speak in his own cause seems just, seems right, in other words. But his neighbor comes and searches him, and in other words, someone else questions it. Someone exposes his claims to cross-examination, and all of a sudden, what sounded plausible no longer sounds plausible. And so what we are finding repeatedly is the traditional view that sounds, so powerful, when the people listening are told, this is the truth, this is all the truth, and this is the only truth, it cannot be wrong. That sounds intimidating. Until someone else comes along and says, well, no, that's not true, and here's the reason why. Here's the evidence it's not true. And all of a sudden, like you said, people with open hearts and open minds discover that there really is another side to the story, and that the evidence to support what they have been told all these years is not good evidence at all. In fact, it's not even evidence. It's just a whole lot of presuppositional claims, and we're going to see that tonight as we examine and review Brother Keith Ritchie's presentation on Matthew 24:36, when Jesus said, but of that day and hour knows no man. Now, you know, I sit and listen to the entire presentation. I wanted to be as objective as possible. I used to believe and teach, I espoused very strongly the very position that Brother Ritchie took and presented in that lesson. And so, number one, I was extremely familiar with what he was going to say, but I wanted to hear if he had any additional better evidence, supporting evidence, from what I was raised with, what I believed, what I espoused, what I taught. And so when, at the very outset of his lesson, he begins with a false presupposition, it was like, this is not going to be a good presentation, because everything after the first 5 minutes was based upon his false presupposition, what he assumed to be true, without ever even offering a single word to prove that it was true. So, anyway, you know, I listened to Brother Drew Leonard, that will be debating Steve Basden in just very, very short period of time. I guess that's next week, perhaps week after next, up in Michigan. Wish I could be there. I just can't do it. But I must say that I was extremely, extremely disappointed. He's a good speaker. I will give him that. He did just a pretty decent job of speaking. But the material that he presented, the so-called arguments that he presented, were just absolutely horrible. So anyway, that's getting ahead of ourselves. What we're going to begin doing tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is we are going to be examining, reviewing, and rebutting the speeches that have been given this week at the South Haven Church of Christ, South Haven, Mississippi. The lectureship title, the lectureship theme is The End of Time. And I thought that was kind of ironic myself, William, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. I you know, as I said before, during the PPW weekend, it's like, you know, you'll sit there for the whole time waiting on something to write down on the end of time, which, you know, I never got to this, you know, I haven't gotten to this point even before, you know, the incident occurred. And even in listening to the speeches, you know, if this is the theme of your lectureship, it seems like someone should kind of just take that topic and dive in and just show us what the end of time is. But there has been none of that at this point. It's just an assumption that is made that these things relate to the end of time, but nobody has actually really said very much about it up to this point.
Yeah, and that's the whole issue. You pointed that out extremely well, and that if you're going to devote a lectureship to establishing the truthfulness of the, quote, end of time, unquote, wouldn't it be really good if some of the speakers actually talked about the end of time? Now, I want to be fair here. I've only listened and watched two presentations. I listened to Brother Richie's presentation. I do not remember him saying one word about the so-called end of time. I will note here a moment what he did say, which he would correlate together and say, well, that's the same thing. But I did not get to watch the entirety of Drew Leonard's presentation, so I don't know that he used the term end of time. But in what I did hear him say, I did not hear him talk about the end of time. Now, I know that Daniel, sitting there next to you, and perhaps Daniel could answer the question whether or not Drew Leonard ever even mentioned the term end of time. But in what I listened to, he didn't. So,
yeah, he doesn't recall that he ever said anything about the end of time. And
right.
So I think you're pretty accurate on that.
Right. So, you know, let me give you an illustration. In our just completed Printer's Pilgrim Weekend, virtually every speaker that I'm aware of, that I remember, correlated what they were saying with the postmillennial view of eschatology to show the fallacy of it. After all, the theme of our Preterist Pilgrim Weekend was the problem with postmillennialism. Well, I think it was incumbent upon us, since that's what we were going to be talking about, it was to show, okay, postmillennialism believes in the redemption of physical creation. Well, William Bell went through and demonstrated that that paradigm of desiring the redemption of physical creation that the postmillennialists believe in is not biblical. Daniel Rogers talked about the millennium and the defeat of Satan, correlated with postmillennialism. Holger Neubauer talked about the new heaven and new earth, the new creation, correlating it with postmillennialism. I talked about the millennium. I talked about Romans 11, 25 to 27, which, by the way, Kenneth Gentry, the most noted postmillennial advocate in the world today, says that Romans 11, 25 to 27 is the classic expression of postmillennialism in the Bible. Well, it's a pretty weak expression of postmillennialism, since it just doesn't work. And so on and on and on, our speakers address the theme of our lectureship. But unless some of the other speakers do so at these power lectures, then it seems to me like they're just really, really, really seriously avoiding. Now, surely someone is going to talk about 2 Peter chapter 3 and say, this has to be the end of time. You would think that that would have to be their position, but who knows? So anyway, William, what struck me, among several things, when Brother Richie was just beginning, he was talking about the question of the disciples. When Jesus said, do you not see all of these things? The time is coming in which not one stone shall be left standing on top of another. And the disciples begin to show him the stones of the building, and that's his response to that. But then the disciples ask, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of your coming, your parousia, and the end of the world, said Brother Richie. And I just have to say, as I shared with Daniel earlier in the day on the phone, it just staggers me that anyone with the resources, the linguistic resources, and the huge number of Bible translations that are available to Bible students today, it is staggering to me that someone would get up there and appeal to Matthew chapter 24, verse 3, as a prediction of the end of the world. And yet, as I mentioned a moment ago, this is the very foundation of everything else he said. Now, let me make note right here, folks. I well understand that even though Brother Richie did not use the term end of time, he almost assuredly would believe that the end of the world is the end of time. So he might very well object to what William and I just said and say, I may not have used the term, but I was talking about the end of the world, therefore these predators are misrepresenting me. So I want to be fair in this. He claims that Matthew 24, verse 3, is about the end of the world. So, William, what's wrong with that view?
Well, one of the things that's wrong with it is the assumption that it is, one, the end of the world, but secondly, the failure to understand the actual language of the text based on the wording that Matthew has used even previously in his writings. The term in the text is, what will be, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming or your parousia and of the completion or consummation of the age? So in that text, they never ask about the end of the world. As a matter of fact, they didn't even have a concept of the end of the world. If you really study the Old Testament scriptures, their concept was not the end of the world. They understood the world was never going to end. But they did understand there would be an end of the age, and particularly the age of Moses that would result in the Messianic age. And that is what they were inquiring about in Matthew 24 and verse 3.
And that is so incredibly fundamental. And, you know, I want to bring up an issue here. And Daniel and I were talking about this just a short time ago on the phone. But it's absolutely fascinating to me about how it is assumed that when the disciples ask about the parousia of Christ, that is talking about a literal, physical, bodily, fleshly coming of Jesus, again, at the end of the world. Now, the question is, where did the disciples get the idea that Jesus, as a 5'5" Jewish man, was going to come out of heaven riding on a literal physical cumulus cloud? Now, if they had that idea, they had to have gotten it somewhere before Matthew chapter 24. So it is very legitimate to ask, in what text, in what pericope of Jesus' teaching did he ever speak about a literal, visible, bodily coming? And here's what's so ironic about this. Perhaps, just perhaps, and I don't know because Brother Richie did not appeal, as far as I remember, to Matthew 16, 27, 28. But traditionally in the churches of Christ, the argument would be, well, in Matthew 16, 27, 28, Jesus said, the Son of Man will come in the glory of the Father with his angels and shall reward every man according as his work shall be. And verily I say unto you, there are some standing here which shall not taste of death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And again, traditionally in the Church of Christ, and folks, I want you to catch the power of this. I'm going to say this again. Traditionally, the majority view in the churches of Christ is Matthew 16, 27 is the, quote, end of the world. After all, it's the judgment and the rewarding of every man. Verse 28 is taken to apply to Pentecost. Now, I do not know. I want to make this abundantly clear. I do not know if Brother Richie takes the traditional view or not. Do you remember him saying even one word about Matthew 16, 27, 28, William?
No, I don't recall him. I don't recall him using that. And looking over the notes that I have, I don't have any reference to it in my notes.
I did not have a single reference to it in my notes. So let's assume that he does take the traditional Church of Christ view, the majority view of Matthew 16:27 being the end of the world, verse 28 being the day of Pentecost and the establishment of the church. Well, here's the irony of the power lectures. Shortly after him, I assume it was shortly after him, Brother Drew Leonard gets up.
The very next speech.
It was the very, I thought it was, the very next speech, and says, brethren, Matthew 16:27-28 was fulfilled in AD 70. Matthew 16:27 is the vindication of the church undergoing persecution, but vindicated in AD 70. So, what do we have here? We have Keith Ritchie, I'm going to assume, and I admit it's without proof, I'm going to assume that he took the traditional view of the churches of Christ, Matthew 16:27, end of the world, verse 28, pardon me, day of Pentecost. The very next speaker gets up and says, no, brethren, no, brethren, no. Matthew 16:27-28 both speak of AD 70. Now, I can assure you, folks, that in that audience, there were a significant number of ministers sitting there going, oh, no. Oh, good grief. You know, Keith Ritchie, you're wrong. Or, good grief, Drew Leonard, you just gave the preterist that passage. But they're both up there telling everyone how wrong we are, and yet they disagree with one another on an incredibly important text.
And to add to that, on the GBN review, they had just taken the position to establish, I think it was B.J. Clark, had just taken the position to establish that traditional view. So within a matter of, how long has that been? 2 months?
Three.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
2 weeks?
I started to say 2 or 3 weeks at the most.
Yeah. Within 2 weeks, we've had them argue for the traditional view of Matthew 16:27-28. And then we have this lecture on the end of time. And then you have a person who comes up who has written several books, by the way, and now poses as an authority on the refuting or refutation of AD 70 and a lot of other apocalyptic language from the book of Daniel and the book of Zechariah. I mean, you know, he's done quite a bit of writing on these things, but says that this refers to 70 AD. And while a lot of preachers in there were saying, oh, no, I know at least two of them in there were saying, oh, yes.
it's just astounding. Okay, back to the question on Matthew 24. Where would Keith Ritchie go to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Matthew 24, when the disciples asked about the coming of the Lord, his parousia, how would he prove that they had in mind the end, so-called end of time, the end of the material creation? Where did they get the idea? And here's, to me, the daunting, daunting challenge to Brother Ritchie. And again, folks, I want you to remember, William and I both were raised to a certain extent. I certainly was raised believing exactly what Brother Ritchie was saying in his presentation. So here we have Jesus doing what? There is absolutely nothing in the immediate context. There is nothing even in the remote context to suggest, to hint in any way whatsoever that Jesus predicted that he was going to come on out of heaven on a literal, visible, cumulus cloud as a 5'5" Jewish man. Nothing. I mean, after all, Drew Leonard has already told us it can't be Matthew 16, 27, and 28. That can't be. Okay. The issue has to be raised. The question has to be posed. When the disciples asked their question, what were they asking their question in response to? Well, the obvious and undeniable answer to that is they were asking their question about the coming of the Lord, the parousia, in direct response to Jesus' prediction of the fall of the temple. Now, let's just set aside the discussion of the end of the world for a moment. But the question has to be raised, where would the disciples ever get the idea of a literal, visible, bodily coming of Jesus out of heaven on a literal cloud at the time of the destruction of the Jerusalem temple? Now, the normal response to that is, well, you see, the disciples were confused. They mistakenly linked the coming of the Lord, i.e. at the end of the world, the literal, visible, bodily coming of the Lord at the so-called end of time. They mistakenly linked that with the destruction of the temple. Question once again, where's the evidence that they had such an idea, number one, of the end of time? Number two, of a literal, visible, bodily coming of Jesus out of heaven in a human body, physical, flesh and blood body. Where did they get that idea?
Right. Now, so in other words,
go ahead.
What you're saying is, in as much as we have these discussions on what happened, if you please, in 70 A.D., there is no one who claims that Jesus appeared in a 5'5" flesh and bone body that was visible and audible in 70 A.D. In other words, they argue that that just could not have happened. And we're in a context, beginning in Matthew chapter 3, that is all about the people of that generation, their lawlessness and murdering of the prophets, and the vengeance that was going to come upon them associated with the fall of the temple. So if that is the context out of which the question has come, then there should be nothing to confuse the disciples at all about what kind of coming would be included in that point. I mean, in that context. Then we would have to identify where the shift is made for such teaching to occur within this context, and then justify that in terms of what is said. And based on everything that we do know, and I may be getting a little bit ahead of where we are, but just based on everything we do know, even in Brother Richie's lesson, he found a dividing line way below verse 3. I'll just leave it at that.
No, you were on a good path there. You were on a good road, and it's completely and totally destructive to him. And let's talk about this context. I mean, you started Matthew chapter 3. For brevity's sake, let's go back to Matthew chapter 21. Because
all right, that's good.
Matthew 21, all the way up through Matthew 24, have similar themes, similar motifs to be found in them. Matthew chapter 21, Jesus told the parable of a man who had a vineyard, and he let it out to husbandmen, and they turned out to be wicked. When the time of the vintage harvest arrived, he sent his servants to them to gather the harvest. They mistreated them. They beat them and mistreated them. They did that repeatedly until finally the master of the vineyard said, I will send my son to them. Surely they will honor him. But instead they said, this is the owner's son. Let us take him and kill him that the inheritance might be ours. And Jesus turned to the Pharisees and said, what will the master of that vineyard do? And they answered, the master of that vineyard will come and utterly destroy those wicked husbandmen. Now, William, I'm going to go out on a limb right here, and I'm going to venture to say that Brother Keith Ritchie would say that that coming that Jesus predicted in destruction and judgment of the wicked husbandmen occurred in A.D. 70. Do you suppose he'd agree with that?
I would think that he would.
I don't remember any ministers in the Churches of Christ that I grew up listening to that would take a different tact on that. I mean, every commentator that I'm aware of that I remember agrees that coming of the Lord of Matthew 21, 40 was A.D. 70. Okay, let's go to Matthew 22. In Matthew 22, Jesus told the parable of the kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is like a certain nobleman who made a great wedding feast for his son. He sent out his servants to call those who had been already invited. That's the force of the Greek there. And those who had been invited began to make excuses. They began to beat the servants, to mistreat them, and to kill them. And the master of the wedding feast was angry. He sent out his armies, and he killed those wicked men and burned their city. Once again, William, do you suppose that Brother Ritchie, or anyone else for that matter, there at the lectureship would argue that that's not A.D. 70?
I would hope that none would argue against that. I'd love to take a survey,
hope.
Though.
Yeah, I would hope.
I mean, how would I love to take a survey just to find out? But at any rate, I mean, that's just absolutely powerful points on both of these chapters focused on...
Yeah, we have Matthew 21, we have Matthew 22, and by the way, folks, Matthew 22, the parable of the wedding, when does the wedding take place? Oh, it takes place, Matthew 25, 1-13, at the parousia of the Lord Jesus Christ, the coming of the bridegroom. I'm not going to develop that anymore, but I hope you see a train coming right along here. So,
well, since you started the train, let me just put the boots on it real quick. I'm not going to do a lot, but I just wanted to point out that the connection here is the wedding, which follows the fall of the city. And that pattern is found in Matthew 24 and other passages throughout the New Testament.
Absolutely. Matthew 24, you have the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew 25, you have the wedding. I mean, it's just, now, they are not divided by long periods of time, because Matthew 24, 29-31 is the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Matthew 25 is the coming of the bridegroom for his wedding. So those are synchronous events, but they're inextricably related to one another, and that's my point. So you have the coming of the Lord to Matthew 21 and destruction of the wicked husbandman. You have Matthew 22, which is technically the coming of the Lord for his wedding, but it takes place at the time of the destruction of the city that killed the Lord's servant sent to them. And let me see. Matthew 23, you have Jesus standing in the temple predicting his coming in the judgment of Jerusalem for shedding all of the innocent blood. And he said it would come on that generation. So we have three pericopes here. We have three stories told by Jesus. Each one related to Jerusalem. Each one related to Jerusalem persecuting the saints. Each one related to Jesus coming in judgment of Israel and Jerusalem for persecuting the saints. All within that generation. Now, all of a sudden, we're supposed to believe that even though in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus has just spoken of his coming at the time of the judgment of Jerusalem for shedding innocent blood, he has just predicted not one stone shall be left standing on top of another. We're supposed to believe that the disciples, even those earlier parables are told bang, 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 bang in proximity with one another time-wise. We're supposed to believe that the disciples are completely ignoring that context of Jesus' coming. And all of a sudden, when he predicts that judgment on Jerusalem, which he has already done in Matthew 21, which he has already done in Matthew 22, which he has already done in Matthew 23, all of which were clearly posited in that generation, all of a sudden, now, when he predicts that very destruction and judgment, they're thinking, oh, I see, he's talking about the end of the world. So the question, I think, is very, very legitimate. Where's the contextual break between Matthew 21, Matthew 22, Matthew 23? And by the way, if you want to throw in Matthew 16, 27, 28, thank you very much, Drew Leonard. We have that text as well. And oh, by the way, Matthew 11 and Matthew chapter 12, we have Jesus saying that if the mighty works that have been done, woe unto thee, Chorazin, woe unto the Bethsaida, if the mighty works had been done and you had been done, Tyre and Sidon, they would have had repented long ago. But the men of, they shall rise up with this generation in judgment. Well, there's the judgment in that generation. So,
and I think someone did bring in that text. I'm not sure if it was Keith Ritchie Okay.
But I know that
text was brought up.
Yes, Drew Leonard appealed to it. The judgment, and it could not be AD 70 because it had to do with Chorazin and Bethsaida and Tyre and Sidon. That's a horribly weak argument. But you'd have to prove that Jesus wasn't talking about that generation, the judgment of that generation, when he said, the men of Nineveh shall rise up with this generation. Well, it says this generation. And so we're supposed to assume, okay, the men of Nineveh are going to rise up with the men of this generation, but they won't rise up in this generation. It may be a million years from now. Well, why wouldn't the men of Nineveh rise up against another generation? No, it's because the judgment has already been established, Matthew 16, 27, 28, as occurring in that generation. After all, it's the judgment of all men, the rewarding of all men. So does that exclude the men of Nineveh, Chorazin, Bethsaida, et cetera, you know, our brethren are literally all over the map when it comes to their interpretation of eschatological passages. They begin with a presupposition about a so-called literal, visible, bodily coming of Jesus as a physical human being out of heaven. They begin with the presupposition of the end of time. And if they do not have an emphatic time statement, and shoot, sometimes even when they've got emphatic time statements, men like David Hester completely ignore them. They wave them away with a mere dismissal and say, oh, time statements don't mean anything. Oh, and then you have men like Drew Leonard stand up and say, brethren, at the very beginning of his lesson, stand up and say, listen to me, brethren. When the Bible says at hand, near, quickly, soon, and shortly, it means exactly that. It's not talking about 2,000 years. I really believe we ought to arrange a debate between Drew Leonard and David Hester on this issue.
Yeah. And he even said, don't even be arguing about this stuff. I mean, he said something to that to that effect. You know, this is not even something we need to be, you know, having controversy over, these terms at hand, et cetera. And then, of course, he gets right up and then denies it in the Second Thessalonian piece. But anyway, let me come in on something here. Yeah. The problem, and Daniel and I kind of spoke about this briefly a little bit earlier this afternoon, is the Church of Christ has never really established what their eschatology is.
Yeah.
And you and I discovered that when we went to Tulsa some years ago for the seminar. And it was, you know,
yes.
That was probably the most pitiable survey that has been taken on people's eschatological views right there within the Church of Christ. They had no idea what the Bible even taught about it, for the most part.
None.
And,
none
and
whatsoever.
Then, yeah. And then to get up in a lecture. And, I mean, could you imagine the consistency? If anybody listened to the lectures that we did at the Preterist Pilgrim Weekend, and how everyone could draw on each person's lesson without any problem. We could just pick out of each person's lesson and continue to build our own lesson. It would be difficult for them to do that in this scenario, in terms of the way some of these things are presented, as you were mentioning a moment ago, on At Hand and some of these other concepts, because they would be all over the place, as you're saying.
Just in the two speeches that we've mentioned, I don't know what Brother Ritchie might say about the time statements, but if he, for instance, if he took David Hester's view on the time statements, that At Hand and Quickly and Shortly doesn't mean that, oh, except when he wants it to, then he would be in direct contradiction. He couldn't even build on Drew Leonard's lesson at all. And I doubt very seriously that he could build on Drew Leonard's comments about the book of Revelation. I doubt it very seriously, because you and I both, Matthew 16, 27, 28. I mean, it would be great to have those two brethren in a debate with one another about the meaning of some of these absolutely fundamental eschatological texts. Instead of lobbing rockets at us, maybe they ought to get together and get themselves together. Now, look, let's be very, very plain, ladies and gentlemen. There's never going to be 100% unanimous consent and agreement within any movement. If there is, I've never heard of it, right? I just don't know. And yet, I have heard Church of Christ preachers say, well, you know, you can't pay attention to these preterists because, after all, they got all these divisions within their camp. They don't even agree among themselves. And in fact, on C. Bays' board, where Scott Claft is the administrator, someone posted on there, I believe it was early this year, perhaps last year, they said, you can be assured that when there's that much division within a movement, it is a false movement. I posted in response, well, okay, let's see. In the Churches of Christ, what do we have? We have congregations in which it is forbidden for women to cut their hair. They must wear a veil. We have churches in which it is wrong to have classes, to have more than one cup, in which you cannot support colleges and universities. And I just went down a long list of the issues that have divided the Churches of Christ. And I made the point to this brother. If it is the case that division within a movement falsifies that movement, then the fact that the Churches of Christ currently have in excess of over 30 divisions, the last I heard it was actually 35 or 36, then that falsifies the Churches of Christ. Is this your position? Well, that was about a month ago, and I hadn't heard back from him yet. Still waiting on him to answer that, just like I'm still waiting on several other brethren on that forum to answer some of the questions that I raised in response to their arguments. But
yeah, I made that very argument with Terry Varner when he visited the School of Preaching some years ago, and I wrote a response to, you know, he claimed that there was division among preterists, and I, because we, you know, had some different opinions on, you know, various things, but all within this context of Christ having come in 70 A.D., mm-hmm. And so I pointed that out in a paper, you know, response that I sent to him, a written response that I sent to him. He never did respond to it, obviously. But the very same points that you raised.
That's exactly the point. You know, this just illustrates how desperate our brethren are, you know, and others are. Kenneth Gentry, in a new book that he just released last year, makes the argument in the preface, very first page of his preface. Well, don't bother studying with these preterists, because after all, if you have five preterists in a room, and if you ask them a question about what they believe, you'll get seven or eight different positions. And oh, by the way, some of those authors don't even agree with themselves. Well, I'm currently doing a review and a response to Kenneth Gentry's book each Friday on my morning musings. And by the way, the viewership of that is very good. And I point out, well, Dr. Gentry is arguing, just like this fellow on As It Is Written, well, if you see division within a movement, that nullifies the movement, that falsifies the movement. Well, would Dr. Gentry accept that? Because there's certainly lots and lots and lots of division within the Reform movement. And they blast each other as heretics within their own movement. And furthermore, Dr. Gentry doesn't even believe some of the things that he has taught through the years. He no longer agrees with his own position on Daniel chapter 12. He used to teach that Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 was the, quote, end of human history, unquote. And now he believes and teaches and has written, guess what? Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 was the corporate resurrection of Old Covenant Israel out of the Old Covenant body of death, being transformed into the new covenant body of Jesus Christ in A.D. 70. When I read that, I just nearly jumped up out of my chair and said, praise the Lord, thank you, Kenneth Gentry. You just became a full preterist. Of course, he denies that. But and here he is condemning the preterist movement. Why? Well, because there's division therein, and because some of the authors within the preterist movement don't even agree with themselves. And here's Kenneth Gentry belonging to a fellowship in which there is tremendous division, and he disagrees with his own writings. Therefore, Kenneth Gentry must be false. I mean, it's staggering to see the logical inconsistencies of so many of these people who argue against covenant eschatology. Now, so we go back to this issue in Matthew 22. If the disciples linked the fall of Jerusalem with the coming of the Lord, where might they have gotten that idea? Well, I would suggest to you that one of the places, and it's only one among many that could be given, one of the many passages that can be adduced is Isaiah 64 through 66. In Isaiah 65 through 66, we have the coming of the Lord to bring in the new creation. Well, I'm fairly confident that Brother Richie would agree that the coming of the Lord of 2 Peter chapter 3 would be the coming of the Lord to bring in the new creation. Well, folks, Second Peter chapter 3 quotes directly from Isaiah 65. So here is Peter anticipating the fulfillment of Isaiah 65. Well, let's see here. Isaiah 65 is the coming of the Lord to bring in the new creation. Well, what kind of a coming of the Lord is it? Well, in Isaiah 64, the prophet says, and really he is expressing the cry of Israel, the corporate Israel, and most scholars agree with this, that Isaiah is the personification here of Israel crying out. And it says, oh, that you would rend the heavens. Oh, that you would come down and the mountains might flow down at your presence. In other words, that the mountains might melt at your presence. As when the melting fire burns and the fire causes water to boil, to make your name known to your adversaries, that the nations may tremble at your presence. Now, in the Septuagint, that's the Greek word prosopon, which means face, and it's equivalent to parousia. And so here, what do we find? We have Israel, we have the prophet, being the personification of Israel, crying out for the Lord to come. to come out of heaven to destroy the earth, to make the nations know that he is God, that the nations might tremble at his presence. Again, prosopon equaling parousia. Oh, but watch this, folks. Now remember, this is what Peter was anticipating. This is the parousia of Matthew 24, verse 3. Now watch this. Verse 1 again of Isaiah 65. Oh, that you would rend the heavens. Oh, that you would come down, that the mountains might flow at your presence, the nations might tremble at your presence. Now watch this. When you did, past tense. When you did terrible things, which we did not look for, you came down and the mountains flowed down at your presence. Prosopon, i.e. parousia. Okay, wait a minute. Isaiah, Israel, is praying for Yahweh to come to destroy the earth at his parousia, to make his name known. And he wants him to come, they want him to come, as he had come in the past. When you did marvelous things for which we did not look, you came down and the mountains flowed at your presence. Now, folks, follow me here. The parousia of the Lord, 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, i.e. the day of the Lord, would be to bring in the new heaven and earth of Isaiah 65, 64 through 66, technically. But the coming of the Lord, the parousia of the Lord, the prosopon, the face of the Lord, of Isaiah 64 to 66, would be a presence of the Lord like previous days of the Lord. So unless someone can prove that Yahweh had come in the days previous to Isaiah 64, literally, visibly, bodily, and destroyed the creation, the physical creation, then since and if they cannot prove that he had come visibly, literally, bodily, prior to the time of Isaiah, if they can't prove that, then guess what? We look to the examples in which Yahweh had come down. And well, for that, we can go to Micah. In Micah chapter 1, Micah is predicting the destruction of the 10 northern tribes. And in Micah chapter 1, 3 and following, it predicted the coming of the Lord out of heaven. The Lord shall come out of heaven and shall walk on the tops of the mountains, and they shall melt under his feet. Well, that's what Isaiah 64 is describing. The mountains will flow at your presence, and they did flow at your presence. So here's the nature of the parousia of the Lord to bring in the new creation of 2 Peter chapter 3. Oh, but wait, the parousia of 2 Peter 3 is the parousia of Matthew 24, verse 3. If it's not, what is it? I mean, after all, I'm real sure that Keith Ritchie would correlate and say that the parousia of Matthew chapter 24, verse 3 is the parousia of 2 Peter chapter 3. But again, the parousia of Matthew 2 Peter 3 is the parousia, the prosopon of Isaiah 64 to 66. But that coming of Isaiah 64 to 66 is a day of the Lord. It is a parousia at like previous days of the Lord. The previous days of the Lord were never literal, visible, bodily, fleshly, physical comings of the Lord out of heaven on literal, visible, cumulus clouds. They were always historical days of the Lord. Oh, I know what they were. They were days of the Lord that Drew Leonard so beautifully said that when the disciples read or heard the language of Matthew 24, 29 through 31, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, you know, all that language, and the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, the stars of heaven falling from the sky, he said, so well, those disciples would have known. That's taken directly from Isaiah 13. That's apocalyptic language. That's not literal language. Oh, by the way, I think Drew Leonard needs to debate Dr. David Hester on that as well. Because after all, Dr.
Keith
Hester
Ritchie.
Said,
Keith
yeah,
Ritchie.
What does, I'm sorry. Well, you know, I'm sorry.
Drew Leonard. Drew Leonard,
yeah.
Yes.
Drew Leonard needs to debate Dr. Hester on the meaning of the language of the Lord coming out of heaven in flaming fire. And, you know, sun being dark and the moon turning to blood, the stars falling from the sky. Because after all, Drew Leonard says that was AD 70. And Dr. Hester says, no, that's the end of time. And maybe, just maybe, Drew Leonard, I don't know. But if Keith Ritchie takes the traditional majority view of the Churches of Christ, then he would say, with Drew Leonard, guess what? The coming of the Lord at the time of the sun being dark and the moon not giving its light, etc., that was in AD 70. That's typical prophetic language. I mean, after all, that was the view of some of the most noted Church of Christ preachers and teachers and commentators. That was the view of Guyon Woods. That was the view of Roy Deaver. That was the view of Stafford North from Oklahoma Christian College, now renamed. I mean, that's been the historical view, folks, in the Churches of Christ like forever. Now, have there been some dissenting voices? Sure have. Burton Kaufman took Matthew 24, 29 to 31 as literal invisible. He may have changed his view on that later in life, as he did on the dating of Revelation. He changed from the late date to the early. So I can't speak to that definitively. But the point of fact is, historically, the majority view in the Churches of Christ is that Matthew 24, 29 to 31 is standard apocalyptic Hebraic prophetic language to describe an in history day of the Lord, not the end of time, not the end of human history, but a divine sovereign intervention into the affairs of men by Yahweh. And all of a sudden, even though Matthew 24, 29 to 31 is AD 70, we're supposed to believe that's not what the disciples were asking about when they ask about his parousia, even though parousia in the Old Testament is used of the historical days of the Lord and is never used of a literal, visible, bodily coming. Now, what was the point I was making a few moments ago? Where would the disciples have gotten the idea of the coming of the Lord at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem? Well, they have the coming of the Lord, the parousia of Isaiah 64. Well, in Isaiah 65, the Lord said to Israel, the Lord God will slay you and call his people by a new name. For behold, I create, let me skip down several verses, I create a new heaven and a new earth. I create Jerusalem a blessing. Well, what was he going to do? He was going to destroy the old Jerusalem and create a new Jerusalem. That is, I suggest to you, the proper context, since the disciples were very clearly disciples of the Old Testament. They were saturated in it. There's not in the Old Testament a single prediction of a literal, visible coming of Jesus at the end of time. It's just not there. So with that background, and with the background of Matthew 21, Matthew 22, Matthew 23, in Jesus' prediction of the judgment of Jerusalem at his coming, why in the world would the disciples all of a sudden jump ship, jump subjects, ignore what Jesus had just been saying, and jump to an event at the end of time when Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple? Folks, that makes no contextual sense. It is not exegetical. It is a violation of hermeneutic. And you know, William, we hadn't gotten very far tonight, so I suppose maybe next week you and Daniel can continue this review of Brother Keith Ritchie's presentation on that day and that hour, since I'll be gone. But folks, I hope you can see some of the incredible self-contradictions within the speakers, just two speakers at the Power Lectures there in Mississippi. And I can assure you there will be other contradictions that we will point out in the coming weeks between the speakers at that Power Lectureship in Mississippi. In the meantime, thank you so very, very much for joining us this evening on Two Guys and a Bible here on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust. We truly appreciate being with us. Look, if you got a question, if you got a comment, even if you want to disagree with something we've said, send us your comment, okay? We'll try to cover it here on the air. We appreciate that. We're more than willing, more than happy to engage your questions. So let us hear from you. And with that said, we will say good night and God bless.
Thank you for joining the Two Guys in a Bible radio broadcast. On behalf of Dunn Preston and myself, we'd like to say, have a very pleasant day and may God bless. Until next time, we'll see you on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust.